Welcome back to Ignite Your Light, a podcast that connects creatives, healers, and entrepreneurs through spirituality and wellness. My name is Riley Webster. I am your host, and I am so excited to be sharing this episode with you. I had the privilege of speaking with Mark Groves, who is known as Create the Love on Instagram. He is a human connection specialist and just a absolutely lovely person to speak with. We spoke about all things relationships, healing breakups, attachment styles, boundary setting, codependency, all of that. And I also asked him some questions that were given to me when I put out a little questionnaire over Instagram. So I'm really excited to share this with you. I found it really transformative and healing for me. So I am also hoping that you feel the same way. So without further ado, here is Mark. Super happy to have you on my podcast. I just absolutely love your content. I love reading your posts, your podcast. I've learned so much from you. So I'm so happy to be chatting with you, Mark.
Well, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm pumped.
Yes. Oh, I'm so happy you're here. So I'd love if you could start off by just speaking about your journey, getting into the work that you are into now, and kind of what happened in your path to make you so interested and amazing at speaking about human connection and relationships.
Man, getting into the work to be here today. Man, all the moments that led to this moment. I wouldn't change a thing, that's for sure. But I think there's many emotional discomforts, many rock bottoms that keep redirecting me. The initial one, though, was for sure the desire to understand relationship was cultivated from not knowing how to be in them, you know, not being successful at them. I had an engagement that ended, and you know, I was engaged to an incredibly wonderful woman, to an amazing woman, but there was, for some reason, I didn't want to be. And I didn't know why. And when that relationship ended, I really looked back and I thought, like, how did I get so disconnected from myself? Like, why do people do things they don't want to do? Mm-hmm. And why, when we are faced with someone who's really incredible, may we not want to be in a relationship with them? You know, that was definitely in conflict with everything I was taught, which was like, get married by 25 to 27, have kids by 30, and if you don't do those things, you're sort of broken.
And yes.
I felt broken. So I started to study relationships. I started to study like what made them work, what made them not. And at the time I was in sales and I was already studying how to change people's behavior, how to get them to buy something, how to get them, you know, I was reading books like How to Win Friends and Influence People, How to Get Anyone to Do Anything. And I just started to be like, wow, I'm so good at communicating everything, but my feelings. So that's not a skill set issue. There's something else going on there that I didn't know what it was. And I think just the emotional pain of one, feeling lost and feeling like a disappointment, because, you know, in a way I couldn't choose the very thing that I was taught to want. You know, I was taught my whole childhood that you get married and you become a good provider and you make a good living and you take care of your family. And when I finally met the moment that I was taught to want, I didn't want it. And that didn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. So how did you kind of undo that and unlearn that conditioning?
Oh, wow. That's it. You know, to unlearn, because we learn so many incredible things, you know, from the ages of like 0 to 8, you're basically learning how to be part of a family, how to be part of a culture, how to be part of a religion. And you don't really know that your brain is creating programs that say, hey, if you become this way, you'll be safe. If you act this way, everyone will love you around you. You don't realize you're doing that until you get to a place where you feel lost, and that the life you're living is not actually your own, but the one that you were taught to live. I think for me, a lot of that undoing has just happened over time. One, learning that that's true, that that is actually what happens, that you create rules about how life is supposed to be, and then you live by those rules, not realizing you're not really the one who picked them consciously. And, you know, a simple example of this might be saying to someone like, hey, why would you do a psychology degree? You'll never make money with that. Like, do a degree and become an accountant, become a doctor. You know, I think those are pretty common narratives that all of us have received about becoming a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer, because you know that you'll make money.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll become secure and you'll be able to take care of yourself, you know. But at some point, you're in that job and you realize that's not actually passionate for you, and that's not actually something you really want to do. And so The undoing of that was first knowing that those exist. The second one was finding which rules I agreed to that aren't actually mine. You know, which things are me and which ones are not. Like I grew up going to a Catholic school. Well, there's a lot of beliefs that Catholicism has that don't resonate with my soul. And, you know, for example, one of those is that sex is bad, that the intimacy is, you're evil if you do it out of the context of marriage. And, you know, other ones I don't like that are very very cultural based and also religious based is that if you get divorced, you're a failure. That's incredibly toxic of a belief to have. Not to mention that just believing that sex is bad, well, all humans are inherently sexual, so that means immediately if we grow up in an environment that says that, then we have to believe a part of us is bad. So just starting to feel into those things, where did I feel shame that wasn't mine, that was more cultural, that was more inherited? And that just continues. You know, I think you continue to undo the layers of what has been who you've become to figure out what you want to keep and what you don't. And that's the beauty of life. That's the beauty of learning.
Yeah, that's a huge one. The seeing relationships when they end as not failures. I think that that's a beautiful example of what is our belief and what is society's. And every relationship can be such a beautiful teacher if you allow it, and not every relationship is meant to last. And that doesn't mean it's not working out. It could be working out that it isn't continuing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, my relationship recently came to a close romantically, and a lot of people sent me messages and said, you know, I can't believe that you and Kylie are no longer, you know, that your relationship ended, and that, you know, love that if you love each other, you fight for it, you know. And I was like, well, one, thanks for the newsflash. I'll be sure to call Kylie and let her know we fight for this, because of course we didn't do that, right? Like, of course we fought for it. We did everything we could because we did love each other. And I think the other thing that's inherent in that comment is that we believe that love ends when a relationship's container changes. And, you know, what people often fail to see is that love, as you just said, is actually sometimes the closing, is sometimes the moving forward. You know, all things live and die. That's just the reality of being a human and being on this life. That's the reality of everything that's on this planet. Mm-hmm. And we, I think, are so afraid of our own mortality that we're afraid of endings. We don't know how to process them. We don't know how to live in them. Mm-hmm. And not to mention that socially, societally, we've created the message that if you're in a relationship, then it's validation that you're worthy. It means that someone chose you. Oh my God. Well, then if you don't have someone, and we see this in the fabric of how people communicate, they say, oh, well, you're single. What's wrong? Why haven't you met anyone? Like, you suffer from some ailment, you know, rather than you might be consciously choosing to wait for a certain reason, or maybe you want to focus on your career, or, you know, you might want to do a number of things. So it's an interesting thing to dissect, because there's so many layers to it.
Yeah, and when we flip it like that, when we think, well, we are choosing that person too, it gives us more, I don't want to say power, but more... we feel more responsible for our lives instead of thinking, well, why hasn't this person chosen me or this person chosen me? It brings our power back where we're like, but I'm choosing someone to come into my life and I want this person to help me expand and grow. So I love that thought of changing the perspective in that sense if someone is single.
Well, what happens if just that, like, if you can sit in that space where you're not defined by a relationship, you know, like, my relationship has ended, but my life is not over. But when I was like 19 and 17, or in grade 9, I remember going through a breakup, all of those rocked me. They like devastated my very foundation because my foundation was built upon another. And now, you know, my relationship really contributed to my life. It was an amazing addition to my life, but it was not my life. And it was not her life. You know, I don't want to speak for her, but, you know, that was a lot of the dialogue we always had was like, we have our own identities and we share a story together.
Yeah.
And because we could navigate that conversation with, if she left me, I wouldn't lose myself. Well, then I can love her and be okay if she left me.
Yeah, totally. So how do you heal from a breakup then? So you have, it sounds like you were in a really healthy relationship where you felt like you had your own identity and so did she, and that, you know, you had really done a lot of work on yourselves to get to that place. What about for people who are going through a breakup or going through an ending? And I think that there's this kind of cultural norm to bypass it and go straight into another relationship or throw themselves into something else or, you know, not really bring things to the surface and really, really feel it. How do people go through a breakup in a way that allows them to choose differently in the next relationship and reflect their growth in the next stage?
Well, so many people do jump from one relationship to the other. They don't feel the space between the two. I sort of like to think of it as in if you're driving a car 100 miles per hour, and then all of a sudden you get out of the car, you feel incredibly how still you are, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you're driving on the highway and then you get to like a school zone. It feels like it's so damn slow, you know?
Yeah.
And the same thing happens relationally. If we're in this intense, sweeping love affair, or we've been together 4 years and then we get out of it, there's a real momentum shift that we have to stay present to. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to just hop back in a car and go 100 miles per hour. And what we don't often do is, you know, there's a few things. One, when we go through a breakup, we often, first, especially if we were broken up with, we think about how they're such a villain. We think about they left us. They didn't do it with love. They didn't do it. You know, we want closure. We have so many different things that are riding on that. And the perspective is still from this state of being victimized. And in that, we tend to fail to ever ask ourselves, how did I contribute to this? And all of us contribute to all relationship outcomes. All relationships are a dance. You know, I was listening to someone the other day say, you know, why am I in a relationship with a narcissist? Why do I keep attracting narcissists? And, you know, narcissist is such a favorite term of everyone these days, and it certainly isn't being used in its clinical definition anymore. It's just sort of lambasted on anyone who's avoidant, and which is not to dismiss when it actually occurs. But my point being is that when someone asks that question, they're not asking themselves, why am I actually a good match for a narcissist?
Yes.
And that actually is, there's so much more responsibility in that question, because that question actually says, what about me? Why is it that I allow behaviors that are clearly red flags to actually be this person has a right to my heart? And so when we don't check in and do an accurate, objective audit of ourselves, then we're going to repeat patterns because we're not looking at what we're doing. So when we say, well, I keep doing this thing, it's not because the thing keeps showing up in your life. If you literally took a left as you were driving when you normally take a right, you end up in a different part of the city or the town. It's the exact same thing with choices in life. It's simply that easy of a Y in the road. But most people don't want to take responsibility for being the driver. They say, oh, I don't know how my car ended up here. This is just where I end up.
Yeah.
And no, there's so much more to it. So much more to it.
Well, it's easier to play the victim card too, right? To say, oh, well, this is happening to me. I have no control. And then to, again, take that power back and realize that we can create our reality is very unnerving and also an amazing opportunity. And I was listening to a little blurb. I haven't listened to the full episode yet, but it was on your Instagram, and you were saying how your heart isn't broken, it's open. when you go through a breakup. And I just thought that that was so beautiful, and it really hit me because I feel like in each ending that I've gone through, you're kind of in this really highly sensitive state, and you can feel really alive too during it. Do you know what I mean? Like you go through this really intense breakup or ending of anything really, and it shows just this beautiful humanness in you that, wow, I can feel this much about someone or about something. I can allow my heart to get that open to feel this much. And I think that heartbreak is one of the most beautiful parts of the human experience, and obviously the most challenging too. But I think that it can show us so much about ourselves and our capacity to love.
100%. And it really is, heartbreak is a rock bottom, but it's a rock bottom that is inviting you to wake up. You know, it's inviting you to feel. When you are heartbroken, you have all these excuses, and I mean that in a good way, is in that if you're heartbroken and all of a sudden you're like, that's bullshit, I don't want to put up with that. People are like, just leave them alone, like they're going through a thing right now. So all of a sudden you can have boundaries. You don't have the emotional energy to put up with bullshit. So in that experience is a really beautiful gift. So when people tell me like, oh, I'm going through a breakup, it's really hard for me to not say, I'm so happy for you. Because I am happy for people in those moments because they literally are being invited to meet themselves. They're being invited to get rid of all the masks they used to wear. They're invited to look at how did they create this? Because often the outcomes we create in relationship are based on what we learned and what we were taught. You know, we'll say like, I never want to become like my parents. And then inevitably we become exactly like our parents. Or we build a story that is the exact opposite, as opposed to seeing that integration is always found in the middle. It's always found in a balance. And we're often very afraid of ending up in a space that is familiar, and then we end up in a space that's familiar. See, that's the curse of it if you don't look at it.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And then it's easy to vilify, like you were saying, those our previous partners in some instances. And I know that you know Lacey Phillips, the podcast host and manifestation advisor, and she talks about how in relationships we can have expanders in our lives who help us, you know, learn something new. And that's all very uncomfortable. So when you go through a breakup with someone who really taught you a lot and really humbled you, it's like, oh, whoa, okay, I have some work to do, right?
Oh, yeah. And the, man, just relationship partners are such good teachers. You know, you want to know what you're not good at, just look at what you suck at in relationship. I mean, it's always a magnifying glass to the things we're not good at because abandonment's on the line, rejection's on the line, our heartbreak's on the line. And really, that's the question is, like, who are you when your heart's on the line? Because you're not who you are when everything's puppy dogs and ice cream and you're eating chocolate and you're sharing a trip to Paris or whatever. You know, don't get me wrong. That's a great part of you. But anyone can get on a plane and be on The Bachelorette and fly in a helicopter and go to a cliff and have dinner. But who are you when you don't get the rose? Who are you when they don't text you back? Who are you when your partner says, I feel disconnected from you? That's where all the skills and tools matter. And till then, you know, again, it's like we can all get through life when life's easy, but when life's not easy, that's who you become, you know, and that's where you want to do the work.
Yes. So you speak a lot about boundaries, and why do you think they're so important, and how do we build better boundaries, especially as empaths?
Yeah, especially as an empath. So many people identify as empaths, and then they think that's the reason to not have boundaries, to justify being a doormat. But it's actually the exact reason you should have boundaries.
You know,
Well, otherwise you'll just continue to be walked on, and it's not a fun experience. But as you said earlier, when someone plays the victim or plays the doormat or plays the empath, there's a whole chorus out there of people who will sing with it. You know, and so it's an easily celebrated perspective. The reason that we need boundaries is because boundaries preserve wholeness. You know, we already are whole. It's just that we don't protect ourselves. So boundaries draw a line around who we are. Now, the challenge for most people is they don't really know who they are because they became something else in order to be loved, in order to fit in order to, you know, receive the applause of other people, in order to be safe. It's a survival strategy. It's nothing to vilify. It's something to be tender with. So when I work with people, a lot of the times if I ask something like, what do you value? What do you need? They won't know. They won't know because they grew up in families where, you know, maybe there was a part of a member of your family who was really angry, who was very on eggshell. You were on eggshells around. Maybe someone in the family had a chronic illness or was sick. And when that happens, when there's one person that the family system pivots around and it's not you, then no one's going to hear your needs. So we don't tend to develop them. We don't tend to individuate. We don't tend to become who we are. We tend to, because out of a survival need, we pivot off other people's needs in order to make sure the home is safe, in order to ensure we're safe. The other thing can happen is if our parents weren't around, or they left, or they abandoned us, or they had two jobs, or whatever, it's pretty hard to develop needs and wants there either, because who's going to hear them? So a really good way to identify what matters to you is to look at what you admire in other people. That's a great way to figure out who you are. And then the boundary goes around claiming that. And a good way to do this is to say, to figure out what you value, you know, and I would say that one of the core values of all humans is integrity. And I would invite anyone who creates a list of values should always add that as the primary value that they live by if they choose to. And when you make integrity one of your core values, then it is being in integrity with your values and who you are that determines how you feel about yourself. And when you create boundaries around those things, then you start to love yourself. And because boundaries have a beautiful symbiotic relationship, when you have no self-worth because you have allowed yourself to tolerate shit behavior or whatever it is, and a lot of people say, well, what does it mean to love myself? And I say it means to just choose behaviors that communicate that. Going for a walk, eating a salad, sometimes eating fries, you know. It's simply asking the question, if I loved me, what would I do? We can easily answer the question, if I loved you, what would I do? But if I loved me, what would I do? And so it's starting to make decisions that are congruent with that. So what happens is I set a boundary that says your behavior is not okay. And in doing that, I say to myself, only certain types of behavior are okay to be around me because I love myself that much. And so what happens is when you start out with no self-worth and you communicate a boundary, you're really going out on a limb. It requires an amazing amount of courage. Because you're really leaping into a space that you don't trust yet. Mm-hmm. So you go from no self-worth to, that's not okay what you said to me. Oh my God, I think I actually care about myself. And so you get self-worth from the boundary. And so boundaries protect self-worth, but they also create self-worth. So they are like a symbiotic relationship. And then as soon as I allow a behavior that violates a boundary, then I now my self-worth takes a hit. So that's how we can see that it's symbiosis. It requires it. It's sort of like becoming your greatest advocate, becoming the curator of what's allowed in your life. That can feel very selfish at first, because if we've never done it and we've made our life about other people's needs, making our life at all about our needs will feel so foreign. Oh my gosh, it feels so foreign when we do that.
Totally. And I think that we're taught in our culture in relationships to almost not have needs, like to meet our own needs, and then our partner maybe enhances certain aspects of us. And in the book Attached that I just read, it actually talks about, no, we all do have needs and we have to communicate our needs. So how do we decipher between communicating our needs, like what needs to be met in a relationship, and then also having someone cater to our insecurities? Like, what is the difference there?
Well, that can be a delicate line, because of course someone who's anxious is going to cater to insecurities.
Exactly.
And most avoidant people, though, won't necessarily... Well, I guess an avoidant person's insecurity might come out as controlling or withdrawn, right? Mm-hmm. It might come out in that way. So just for example. So let's say, for example, in a relational dynamic, in texting, one person texts, the other person doesn't reply in a certain amount of time, let's say it's early on in the dating phase, people have to understand that all early parts of a dating phase are filled with some form of anxiety because we don't know where we fit. And so it's in the determining where we fit and dancing in that space that we really start to see how we behave in terms of our feelings. And so, I mean, for context for people listening, our attachment system is basically a radar that is constantly monitoring for the safety and security of our relationships. And that's not just romantic relationships. That's relationships of all type. This can happen on teams, in workplaces, happens in families. It's everything. And our primary attachment is with our mother generally, and it's determined in the first couple of years of our life. And that is predictive of how we attach as an adult. Now, the beautiful thing is you can change how you attach, so you can change it, so you're not destined to a life of it. The other side of it is just to give people an idea of how it works. It's from a study where they looked at a baby, a toddler that was playing, and they looked at how the toddler responded when mom left the room and mom came back. So in the first example, mom leaves the room, she comes back, the baby's crying, the baby's like, you know, not verbal, but crying, and the behavior, the baby reunites with mom, but then doesn't want to leave mom's side because there's an underlying belief that if you leave, I don't trust you'll come back. And the second type, and so that's anxious. The second type is mom leaves, mom comes back, baby reunites with mom, and then goes back to playing, baby trusts mom, so that's secure. The last type is the baby doesn't leave. Mm-hmm. The mom leaves, mom comes back, baby acts like, I didn't even notice you were gone. And so that's avoidant but what's really going on in that last baby is that inside their body, they're physiologically responding in the same way as the anxious child. It's just expressing differently. So that's why it's so easy for someone to pivot from anxious to avoidant, because they haven't actually changed how they attach. They're still in an insecure attachment. It's just showing up differently. So that's why someone can be like, why didn't you text me back? And then they over text, and then they withdraw when someone actually goes to talk to them and love them. They're like, no, now we're a little too close. I better pull away. Like, I'm finally getting what I want. Who wants that? And security, the underlying characteristic of a secure attachment is your partner's needs matter as much as your own. Not more than your own, which would be anxious. Not less than your own, which would be avoidant. So bringing back to the original question about, okay, well, how do you differentiate like having a need versus nurturing an insecurity, right? Is that mm-hmm. what, did I get that
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
Well, needs come from values. They come from wholeness. They come from a place of like, what's important to me is that if we're going to be in communication, when you leave 2 days between a text, I don't feel important to you. Now, most people would lose their goddamn mind if they had to say that in the beginning of dating, right? Like, they'd be like, I can't say that. Yes, and, right? Because you're not going to say that on the first date because you're going to sound like a crazy train, you know? But when you get more secure, so let's say you're in date 5 or 6 and their behavior has changed. They used to message you back. It is so normal to say, hey, like, I've noticed that we tend to communicate a lot. And more recently, it's felt as though you've fallen off a little bit. And I just wanted to check in with you and see, am I picking up something? Is there a reason that this might be happening? Now, to a lot of people, that question is terrifying.
Yeah, totally.
But why is it terrifying?
Mm-hmm. It's because it's hitting that, like you said, that underlying fear of abandonment and rejection, I would say. But it's also like, don't you want to know that you're not wasting your time with someone? Like, don't you want to know that this person has the capacity to meet those values of, let's say, communication?
Right. So that's where knowing mm-hmm. what standard you want to hold in your relationship is so important. Mm-hmm. Because if I say that, okay, communication is important to me. Now, if I ask 100 people, what is the most valuable quality to successful relationships? 99% of people will say communication. Mm-hmm. You know, it might get like kindness, generosity, but let's be honest, 99% of people will say communication. But yet, if I actually followed how they communicate, most people don't communicate well, right? So it's a spoken value, but it's not a lived value.
Right.
Also, most people don't actually learn how to become great communicators. It's a skill. It's not something you're just born into. You might be blessed to be in a family that models it better, but it's not like it's limited. You could go read tons of free information. You could watch YouTube videos on it, and you could become a master. You could become a master communicator. So in this context, let's just go back to this example. I have two choices here. I have the conversation, and I do it in the way that I gave. Mm-hmm. And so now what I've done is I've said to myself, your values matter, and communication matters to you, and what you want in a relationship, you're modeling. So now, what I've done is create a dating filtration process just by my behavior. If the other person doesn't hear it in a way that's receptive, let's say they get defensive, and often most people will because they don't know how to hear direct communication, but then they're open to it, and they're like, you know what, I have dropped off a little bit. I've been a little busy with work, and da-da-da, and I haven't prioritized it. Or they might say, I'm actually not in the place where I want a relationship right now. Because mm-hmm. that's usually what happens, right? When mm-hmm. there's a drop-off in behavior, there's usually a reason for that. We're afraid of the truth, so we ignore the truth. And instead, we allow fate to navigate us forward. That's not fate. That's actually, that's choice, really. Mm-hmm. And so what happens there is I've now just filtered someone. I've now just, because of how I show up, the other person can't show up on the same level, so they either drop away or rise up. But I don't shrink. That's the key to this. I don't shrink. And in that, my self-worth and my values are protected. So I don't, this is why dating is such a powerful experience. It's so important because it's a great training ground for healing. Mm. And what a better place to practice than losing people who you don't have a high relational value to. And I'm not saying that they're not valuable and connections aren't valuable. I'm saying that when you get lost in the, you went on a couple dates and then, you know, as my friend calls it, that she gets last man on earth syndrome. That every time she gets a connection, she's like, this is the last person. And we let the feeling of connection mean that it initiates an abandonment process of ourselves.
Okay, can you explain that a little more? It initiates an abandonment process of ourselves. So do you mean like we're willing to put our needs last for the sake of nurturing this connection?
Yeah, I'm willing to lose me to keep you. I'm willing to sell out my own values to keep you. I'm willing to live in a scarce way where this connection to you is more important than my connection to myself. Mm-hmm. Totally. So if you look at, well, if you look at the types of boundaries there are, so there's three types of boundaries. There's a porous boundary, a rigid boundary, and a secure boundary. So a porous boundary is I receive. I take too much. I take too much, like, as in I take too much bullshit. I get walked on. I tolerate not okay behavior, the way I'm being spoken to, inconsistencies in communication, trust. And then eventually the response to that is usually a rigid boundary. I blow up. I push back. I create a wall. And I don't allow you near me, and I usually do it in this pressure cooker sort of way, right?
Totally.
And then the last one is I allow behaviors that are okay, ones that are safe, ones that earn the right to have access to my heart, and I don't allow ones that don't. And so that's a secure boundary. So in the first one, the porous boundary, I'm connected to another person, but I don't feel protected in that experience. The mm-hmm. second one, I'm connected to... I'm not connected to another person, but I feel protected. And the third one is I feel connected and protected.
Interesting.
So it's a really great way to think about it. Like, how can you be connected to another person and still feel connected to yourself? See how that that boundary setup, those three types of boundaries, are the exact same archetypes of the attachment styles?
Yeah.
So a porous boundary would be more of an anxious attachment style, an avoidant one would be a rigid, and a secure one would be a secure boundary. So the same structure sort of looks at how we, you know, you and I have spoken about this previously, but like an empath would be more identified as an anxious person, a narcissist would be seen more as an avoidant person, not to mention that codependency, the codependent person would be anxious, and the person who is the drug addict, the alcoholic, the narcissist, the whatever, would be on the other side, the avoidant side. So these are all just different ways of systemizing relationship, mm-hmm. and they all will make sense for us in different ways. Some will resonate and others won't. The only thing I do see is that in the archetypes that we use of empath and narcissist is that automatically removes responsibility from the empath.
Agreed, for sure. Because it's still the, it's your fault, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, there's like support groups based on this. Mm. You know, it's like, not to say that when it happens, it's not incredibly painful.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to dismiss that. But it is to say that I have experienced most people when they talk about having dated a narcissist, they're usually just avoiding people. People mm-hmm. who don't know how to face conflict, people who run. So if you think about the baby, we'd never be upset if the baby shut down and didn't have, you know, didn't express its feelings. We'd want to be more tender. And this is not to say that you should go saving people who are avoidant. You shouldn't, because that's a classic excuse for someone who is in that type of dynamic. Like, oh, I should work more. I should do more. No, yeah. The saving of all people who are dysfunctional is the saving of ourselves. That's because our own dysfunction is the desire to save them. That's mm-hmm. that's it. It's like stopping doing that is actually the healing.
Right. Because it's a mirror too, right? Like we've attracted yeah. people into our lives because they are our mirror. And it's become so evident, like you were saying, of what needs work and what needs healing when we're in a relationship, because it's just right in front of us like that.
Well, yeah, and so many people think about this. Like so many people, when their partner gets sober, become nutty. Because they ran out of jobs. They don't have anything to do mm-hmm. anymore. Their whole totally. Job has been to save the other person. So then when they have to sit in the own space, their own space, you know, this is what Al-Anon is. Al-Anon is a support group for people who date alcoholics or who are family members and friends with alcoholics. It's all enabling. You know, it's not to say that it's not incredibly painful to be in a relationship with someone like that. But it's also painful to be in a relationship with someone who's always trying to fix you, because the endless feeling you get is that you're never enough, that nothing's ever enough.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. No, that resonates hugely. So I'd love to move on to just a few questions from my community. One of them is, what are your tips for rebuilding trust in a relationship?
Well, I don't even think it depends on what kind of trust was broken, because the act of trust being broken is often a trauma. You might call it a small T trauma rather than a big T trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I did a podcast with Julie Gottman on this subject, who's an expert at that, and she talked about how trauma is defined as anything we couldn't prepare for. And I loved that. It sort of gives this broad definition to like, yeah. and permission to have pain around things that just are unexpected. So the violation of trust, one is, they talk about this process that they call atonement, attunement, and attachment. So the atonement part is that the person who violated the trust atones, that they apologize, that there's remorse, and it's sincere. And that, you know, they're there to try to repair. Stephen Covey has an example where he talks about relationships being like bank accounts. And when you take a massive withdrawal, you need to make deposits. And you need to make deposits till the balance is back where it was, and maybe beyond that. So the atonement part is the apology, the reparation. This might be, you know, where you get to say, hey, I need to have access to your phone. You have to start to build boundaries around what do you need in order to trust someone again. I need you to not communicate with that person anymore. I need you to be clear with them about our relationship, whatever it is. Second one is attunement, is really attuning to your partner again, getting to know them again. In the context of infidelity, I love what they said, which is the old relationship's over. The old relationship's dead. And the new one is what you build from here.
Mm.
I love that because, look, the old relationships that create a breach of trust, you can't build a foundation on them anymore because they're rocky for sure. So you get to then, you know, say what attunement is. And then, of course, is attachment, which is where you connect again. You go deeper. Intimacy reengages. In infidelity, that's tough because as the Gottmans were talking about when I had them on, they talked about how that often is re-injuring for the person who's had the breach of trust.
Right.
Because they start to think about the intimacy with another partner, if there was something intimate. And and that re-injures them, and then they sort of need a little more atonement at that point. So the rebuilding of trust is really, you know, I gave the example of infidelity, but I think simply put is, how is trust broken? Acknowledging that there needs to be remorse from the side that broke the trust. There also needs to be an examinement of self. Do I trust people who are untrustworthy? Do I give too much to people who are not worthy of that? Do I have a price of admission and a standard that people need to meet? That's so important.
Yeah. Coming back to that self-reflection piece about the situation.
Yeah, like I see so many people who are, their trust is violated over and over and over again. And then they say things like, I feel like I'm going crazy. And I'm like, well, one, you've been lied to a number of times, so you're going to go crazy because you're putting yourself in a rewounding situation over and over again. So your body is going like, if I go crazy, maybe you'll save us.
Yeah.
And the second side of it is, when you call someone out on something they did that was dishonest, and they say, I didn't do that. No, that picture's not of me. You know, they try to do this. And if we believe them, even though we know the truth, then we now live in a world where lies are the truth. Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty hard to trust oneself when we have to abandon the truth in order to be in a situation. You can't trust yourself because you're going to go crazy because you live in a world where you can't stand on solid ground. You can't even trust your own word. You can't even trust that if you see something that is true, you'll claim that truth. So then if you learn something about yourself, you also won't trust it.
Right. You know,
so self-trust gets, we basically are putting our self-worth and our trust in someone else who's not trustworthy.
Yeah.
And when we do that, we're going to get anxious. We're going to experience anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm. Totally. No, I love that. Okay. Another question. How can you support someone going through a change without losing yourself in their stuff?
Well, I would say that one is having understanding of what they're doing with the change. Like, what is the process that they're going through? And also, how can you also go through a change as they do that? Where it's not about them. That, like, maybe their focus on themselves is also an opportunity for you to focus on yourself.
Mm. And maybe it's a good opportunity to create more boundaries as well.
Yeah, to not be dragged down with someone's stuff, but to also say, like, I'm here for you. It's a Hawaiian tradition. I forget what it's called, but it's that, I believe, and I don't want to butcher it, but I think I have it the memory of it right, that someone will hear someone talk about something, like complain about something, but on the third time they turn around and walk away. So they don't let them complain anymore. And I think that is an act of love. I know, it's kind of funny, right?
Yeah.
It'd be the worst to have happen to us. Like, hey, remember that? And they're like, they just turn around. They're like, fuck, peace out.
I like it, though.
I mean, it shows you that, like, you know, I don't want friends who let me live in average. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to let me live in a space. I think there's a difference between, you know, in my podcast I talked about how the amount of pain you feel from heartbreak is actually evidence of the amount that you love.
Yeah.
Like it's actually the very thing, like the very thing we want to avoid is the very evidence that love exists. And someone said to me that if not properly explained, then someone can say, oh, well, that's like glorifying suffering. And I thought, okay, maybe. But I don't think so. For me, I think it's actually the difference is there's a difference between living in your pain and learning from your pain. And for me, learning from your pain is asking it why it's here. Why did it happen? What is it here to teach you? And then rising from it and not repeating it. And when you turn towards your pain and you listen to it, it's really, really, it's the most powerful catalyst. And it's so wise. Pain is so, so wise. That if we just breathe into it and we say, what happened? Mm-hmm. What can you tell me? Mm-hmm. Your pain will offer you the most inspirational message. It'd be like Tony Robbins in a breath, you know? But the difference is that you have to change your fucking life.
Yeah.
Like when pain speaks to you, you have to change or you will repeat it.
Yeah. That's the thing. Awareness is pointless unless it turns into some type of action and change.
Yeah, and so many people get lost in books, and they get lost in course after course. But look, all the courses and all the books say the same thing, which is love yourself, choose yourself, examine yourself, learn yourself, but make a different fucking choice. Like at the end of the day, you have to make a different choice.
Yeah,
because otherwise it's just bullshit.
Totally.
You know, you write a book that's not actually backed with action.
Yeah.
It's going to be useless.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like knowing something but not being something, which is the exact same thing as dating, which is I want someone who's a good communicator, but I'm a shit communicator.
Yeah.
I want someone who's honest, but I don't tell the truth or I hold back truth. You don't get to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you hold back truths from your partner and then you're upset when they don't tell you the whole truth, you're doing the same thing. You're just mad at them because you created it.
Totally. Yeah, 100%. Okay, last question here. How do you navigate having the pull to leave a long-term committed relationship when you still love the person, but you're in a huge process of growth and transformation?
Well, I think there needs to be permission that sometimes the growth and transformation of a relationship is actually its transition. I'm not saying that's always true. And I think that we live in two extremes right now that are at one. I mean, we live in a lot of extremes right now, but in the context of relationship. You know, we have a previous generation that wasn't even allowed to get divorced, so it was illegal to do so. So a lot of them live with the narrative that everyone today leaves relationships too soon. You know, that's a common thing we hear.
Mm-hmm.
The other side is that we live in a culture and an experience where I'm one swipe away from a new person. And so that can cause us not to want to deal with any struggle. Oh, if you loved me, you'd just get me. I mean, that's a lot to put love on. That's not really fair. So we have these two extremes. So how do you know when to leave? Well, the first thing that I decide when I'm working with anyone who asks that question is, it's not up to me to decide. Right? Like as soon as I start to project what I think someone should do onto them, I'm not offering them truth. Because people already know within them. And people have to leave relationships to know they should stay. That's mm-hmm. just a reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know that something matters to you when you leave it and you want it back. And so I don't think people can really make the wrong decision, because in the wrong decision is so much learning that you didn't have before you made the decision. So you shame the part that you just learned when you fucking didn't know the shit right before the decision. So then you sit in the pain of that knowledge, not changing your life and creating the relationship you truly want. So it's kind of ironic how it traps us. What I would invite is, when people are in relationship, they often lose themselves. You know, they wake up in a relationship and they go, who am I? Where did I go? I haven't paid attention. I haven't asked what I want. I don't know what I want. And so they don't, when they're in the relationship, they start to try to individuate. They try to pursue their own passions. They start reading books they never read before. And the other partner will often, in response to that, get scared that their partner's growing away from them. And sometimes the partner growing will feel like this is a rejection or a resistance to their expansion, that they're being rejected, just as they're finding themselves, you know?
Yeah.
They feel like their partner is like, no, don't change. But really, the underlying intention of the no, don't change is, I'm afraid you're going to grow away from me. And I think the important part of that inquiry, because sometimes people do become controlling in that situation, they end up pushing away their partner even more, the person who's fearful. And so I think the important inquiry there is to just actually, instead of defending your right to grow, is to say, one, this is what I need to grow. And so you're invited to create boundaries around your values and your needs. Mm-hmm. Now, when you change the dance in relationship, which is what happens when we put in boundaries where there were none, is you change the agreements that the relationship was based upon. So if you have no boundaries between you and another, they're often lost within your own passions and your own dreams. They don't know how to differentiate. So when you start to own your own time, like, hey, I'm going to go to the gym. What? And maybe you used to cancel that stuff or it wasn't important to you before. Well, they're now invited to individuate themselves. Well, in that space of two people individuating is attraction. That's where chemistry is born. Chemistry is lost when you lose yourself in another. Chemistry is born when there's space between you and another. And so there will be more chemistry eventually, but man, is it ever terrifying to individuate within a relationship that's codependent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it really is about exploring, what is it? Why do you want to leave the relationship now that you're growing? The other side of it too is like, If your partner is growing and they're inviting you to participate and you're not going to, it is the beginning to the end. It really is. Mm-hmm. If you don't listen, because they're inviting you and you might be scared and you might be afraid. They might have asked you to go to therapy and you don't want to. But I'll tell you, you will want to when they do leave you. You'll wish you had done all the things they asked.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Oh, thank you so much for coming on to my podcast and just for all of your beautiful insight and knowledge. This was so amazing. And honestly, like the highlight of my podcast journey so far has been speaking to you. So I'm so appreciative and grateful to be able to connect. And I hope that people found this super helpful because I definitely did.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And to be the highlight of someone's podcast journey, like the ultimate compliment.
What a trophy.
I swear to God, when someone else steals that trophy, I want another challenge at it. Because, of course, your expansion will create that. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I really do. Thank you. This was awesome. Thank you so much for listening. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. I've linked all of Mark's information below, so feel free to follow him on Instagram, check out his website. I hope that you have a beautiful rest of your day, and we will be in touch next week.